I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to The Connection. We've all experienced gut feelings, butterflies in the stomach, goosebumps, sweaty palms, tension in our body, a voice in our head telling us to do something. These intuitive reactions come on quickly from our unconscious mind, bypassing deliberate thought, and are hard to explain. Our brains are constantly processing information, including sensory data about the world we live in, and storing it for future use. Now, intuition used to be thought of as magical, mystical thinking out of the reach of science. But now researchers are finding that gut feelings, hunches, our sixth sense, our intuitions, whatever we call it, have a lot to tell us and can help us make better choices. Our guest, psychologist and neuroscientist Joel Pearson, has been researching intuition for many years. He's director of Future Minds Lab at the University of New South Wales in Australia, and he's got a new book, The Intuition Toolkit, The New Science of Knowing What Without Knowing Why. He joins us on The Connection today to help us understand how intuition works, when to trust your gut, and when to rely on your conscious mind. And Joel Pearson, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You have a very specific definition of intuition, and I almost hate to start with a definition, but I think it's important that our listeners know exactly how you define intuition. Do it for us.
Yeah, so I thought long and hard about this, and I wanted to come up with a definition that was for two reasons. One, to try and build a science around intuition, like you said. We need more science around it. And two, something I could build a practical guide out of. So I define it as the learnt, productive use of unconscious information for better decisions and actions. And there's a couple of choice words in there. So one is the learnt. So it's something we have to learn through experience. And we'll come back to that, I'm sure, in a minute. But crucially, it's about the unconscious information in our brains, right? Our brains are just processing this huge flow of information all the time. And we use this metaphor in neuroscience that this iceberg metaphor, that we're only conscious of the tip of the iceberg, and the bulk of the information that our brain is processing through all our senses just goes by unconsciously. So the simple way to think about intuition is learning to tap into this unconscious information. And if you can do that reliably and you can trust that information, right, it's a whole new reservoir of data, of information that you can use to make better decisions.
Would you say another way to say that is that it's insight without accessing conscious reasoning? I don't know if that's any more helpful or not.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah. So that's another way to say it. And so it's a way to tap into that information. Now, when it comes to intuition, there's been people in psychology have been arguing back and forward. There's evidence that it's good. There's evidence that it's bad, right? And both sides of the argument are right, if you want to say it like that. In other words, sometimes we can rely on it, sometimes we can't. And for some topics we can, and other topics we can't. And that's really the theme through this book. Besides having the science to measure this and understand it now, we don't want to have a black and white rule about intuition. It's good or it's bad, right? It's nuanced. It's a little bit gray. And so we need to know the situations where we can trust it and the situations we can't.
And we will get to all of that. Let me just dig a little bit deeper here, because we do call it kind of a gut feeling and something that we experience in our bodies. So do our bodies know something under certain circumstances that just doesn't compute or connect with our brains?
Yeah.
Our conscious brains?
Yeah, exactly. And that's spot on. That seems to be the case. So what happens is we can, our bodies have access to information that our conscious mind doesn't have access to. So we see this in sport, in actions, and we see this with emotional stimuli as well. So I can bring you into the lab, Marty, and I can show you through your eyes, you know, emotional images, scary spiders or snakes and things like that. And it's no surprise that the emotional parts of your brain will respond to that, right? Particularly something called the amygdala, this sort of part of the limbic system will respond to that. But what I can then do is, through tricks of neuroscience, I can render those images unconscious. So I can take away your conscious awareness of those images, but they're still being presented to your eyes. So we know your eyes still processing them. We know parts of your brain are still processing them. And if we measure the limbic system, the emotional parts of your brain, they're still responding. So a lot of the information is still there in the brain. You just never see the images. They're completely unconscious. And in the book, I talk about this. I give this a name. I call it emotional inception, like the Christopher Nolan film, right? Because we're incepting emotional information into the brain. And this is fascinating on a number of levels, but it's also one of the crucial ingredients you need if you want to try and study intuition. So we can measure this emotional response in the body to things you're not conscious of. So your body has access to information in your brain that, if you like, you don't. Say it in a funny kind of way. And you can think about this. There's this word called interoception, which is a fancy word just for describing how your body sort of monitors the internal state, its internal perception, right? If you're hungry, cold, too hot, need to go to the bathroom. So that's internal perception. And as I expose you to these emotional images, your heart rate's going to go up. You're going to start sweating just that little bit more. And so your body's responding in multiple different ways. Your physiology is changing. And so if you can learn to tap into this body response, it's just like you said, the body's picking up on information that you're not aware of. So that's a crucial part of intuition. So, you know, you walk into the restaurant, and in those seconds as you're walking in the door, maybe you get this funny feeling. Maybe it's positive. You're like, I'm loving this restaurant. Let's get coffee. Let's get lunch here. Or maybe it's not so positive. Maybe there's just something that sort of feels funny in your body. People talk about it literally in the gut, this sinking feeling, sometimes in the chest. Sometimes people talk about it in the sweaty palms or, you know, in the fingertips. And it's sort of a red flag. And in that second or two, you think, let's go across the road to that other restaurant. I don't know why, right? So the knowing what without knowing why, you don't know why. But you're picking up on these bodily signals, which has access to the unconscious information.
Let me just pick up on a couple of things, because we are sort of aware of those five senses, you know, the visual, the auditory, the olfactory, the tactile, and the gustatory or taste. You mentioned interoception, and this is our perception of things that are kind of in our body. You describe it as a kind of mapping system that we're constantly sort of monitoring in a very unconscious way how our body is reacting, whether we're hungry, whether we're stressed, whether we're feeling ill. And that's key to understanding intuition.
Yeah, particularly with the feeling. Yeah, it's key to sort of learning to tap into this bodily response. So the reason they call it the gut response or gut feeling is not because it's to do with, you know, the microbiome and the neurotransmitters that are in your gut, although that is something interesting and that does affect cognition and mental health, but it's because you feel it in the body, right? When I meet someone and there's just something off, I feel it in my body. And in the book, I talk about these famous cases of mountain climbers. John Muir, who's a famous Australian mountain climber who was, you know, climbing Everest in the early 80s. And he's done all kinds of, you know, walked across Australia and kayaked around Australia and done amazing things. And he talks over and over about this heavy dis-ease, this sinking feeling in his gut, saving his life over and over again. And so it is tapping into interoception to feel the information and learning to trust that. Again, as I'm sure we'll get to, there are a number of rules I've sort of developed around intuition, because sometimes you can't trust it and you shouldn't trust it.
And I do want to get to that, but I thought the John Muir story was really fascinating. He was climbing Everest and he just got this feeling like, I can't go on. But interestingly, as you describe, this is a very skilled and experienced mountain climber. So he knew the mountain, he knew the weather. So he was able to intuit, it sounds like, that something wasn't right.
Yeah. So they were, I think it was 1984, and they were doing this summit attempt. And it was early in the morning, it was bitterly cold, the wind's blowing, and they're kind of at this point of no return. And he's famous, John's famous for having this ironclad stomach. You know, he can eat anything off any street stall from anywhere in the world, yeah. Right? But all of a sudden he had this heavy sinking, he calls it dis-ease, sinking feeling. And it was like, something's not right. And he started thinking what it could be. Maybe it's the wind, maybe we're too tired. And he just came to the conclusion that they shouldn't make the summit. And in these days, in the 80s, it's not like it is now, I should say. It's not like you know, you don't have technicians and medical health experts with you, and you don't have oxygen tanks and high-tech, you know, energy gels. They didn't have Sherpas. And so they'd worked, you know, 2 years up to this point. And so it's a real make or break. And there's a huge amount of pressure to make the summit. And he just all of a sudden said, no, we can't do it. I'm going to turn around. I'm going to back climb. And the team was shocked. And then he sort of, they chatted about it. They talked about it. And then another co-climber decided to back climb with him. But then two others decided to go for the summit. And so the team split up. And he continued climbing back to that camp from the night before. And about an hour later, they heard a sort of what sounded like an avalanche, and they looked up. And unfortunately, those two climbers that had continued to the summit came hurtling down and just missed them, almost took them out on the way down, and they fell to their death. So it's this quite strong and dramatic story where he followed his intuition, and it saved his and one of his teammates' life. But to be honest, he has many stories, you know, rock climbing, kayaking like this, where he's been guided by this internal feeling that is not necessarily logical. He can't always say why or where the feeling's coming from. And so I think that's a case that, importantly, like other stories in the book, he has, like you said, a lot of experience in these situations, mountain climbing, all different mountains, climbing on rock, climbing on ice and snow. And so if I was up on the mountain, you know, I wouldn't trust my intuition. So, you know, in the same way that if you've just learned to play chess, you shouldn't try and be an intuitive chess player. You need to put in the hours, the time to become an expert.
We're almost up in our first break here, but I wonder, just using him as an example, whether, you know, athletes, people that are very good at a particular sport, something they have worked really hard on and have to react very quickly to, whether they have intuitive skills based on their, again, experience and knowledge and skill.
Absolutely, Marty. So this, I was talking really about interoception, about emotional content. So the other way we have access to the unconscious is through actions, through motor movements, moving the arms. And we see some amazing cases of this. And so just like with emotion, with physical movements, there seems to be a difference in what the body has access to in terms of unconscious information and what our conscious awareness has access to. So there's all kinds of demonstrations of this in the literature and neuroscience, psychology. There are visual illusions that your visual system will fall for. But if you reach out and grab part of the visual illusion, your hand won't fall for it. In other words, I can make you see a circle that's either too large or too small, or larger or smaller than it actually is. And you'll see that visually. But if you try and reach out and grab the circle, your hand will adjust itself to the perfect actual size of that circle. So there are examples like that where we can show good evidence that the system, the motor system and movements don't fall for these illusions. In other words, there's a different threshold.
I hear you. We have to take a very short break, and we are talking about intuition with our guest psychologist, Joel Pearson. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and our guest is psychologist and neuroscientist Joel Pearson. And he has been studying intuition for many years, putting it to the test in his lab in Australia. And he joins us to explain where gut instincts come from, when we should trust them, and how we can use them to make better choices. He's got a new book called The Intuition Toolkit. Joel, you do describe, and in fact, I'm going to quote you here, humans are very bad at knowing what our emotions are and where they come from. And as an example, you describe taking a woman out for a date, and your first date involved rock climbing. And I have to say, if you had invited me out for a date and the first date would have been rock climbing, I would have turned you down. But nonetheless, she did not, and off you guys went. And there was, of course, the adrenaline of climbing and your racing hearts and sweaty palms and all the things that we associate with intuition also can feel like the feelings of attraction. So help us sort of understand what the brain is doing under these circumstances.
Yeah, so this is this we turned out not to be that suited for each other. But at the time on this first date, we were, you know, the chemistry was so strong. We felt it. We felt the emotion. And it stuck with me for a number of years afterwards. I kept thinking, why? How do we get it so wrong? And then I realized it was an amazing example of something called arousal misattribution. Right. So humans are pretty lousy at figuring out where certain feelings come from, right? So in that example, we were confusing the adrenaline and the spike in heart rate and all the excitement from the rock climbing with our feelings for each other. And there's now these famous experiments, which in the business we call the Rickety Bridge experiments, where they did something very similar. They had people stand on either a very solid, wide, stable bridge or very high and thin and wobbly, sort of one of those sort of rail bridges that's moving all over the place. And they ran experiments on there. And they found exactly that when people are in this sort of heightened adrenaline-like situation, they confuse these feelings for feelings for other people. Right.
And I'm also thinking, even riding a roller coaster, it can be fear and it can be excitement, or it can be both at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, this is a trick that you see the producers of lots of TV shows like The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, right. These kind of shows, they'll put them in these situations where they'll get these heightened emotions and adrenaline, and they want them to confuse that with their feelings for the other people to, you know, spice the show up a little bit. So it's a bit of a trick for producers and things like that. But it tells us something about how the brain works, that we're not good at knowing where feelings come from. And this is important when it comes to intuition, that we can feel these different things. We can feel stress, we can feel anxiety, and we can confuse those for feelings of intuition. So really this brings us to one of the rules of mine, that we don't want to practice intuition when we are feeling stressed, when we're feeling anxious or even depressed, because we will confuse these different feelings, right? If you're feeling anxious about getting on a plane, that's your anxiety about flying. It's not your intuition about this upcoming trip. It's not a premonition. It is probably your anxiety. And so we need to not trust our intuition when we have heightened emotion. And I should say, it's not just negative, it's also positive. You know, just fallen in love, if you just won the lottery, right? If you just won something and you're super excited, you're on top of the moon, you shouldn't trust your intuition there either, because you're going to get confused. You're going to think these heightened emotions are the intuition speaking, and you're going to make a bad choice.
For people that have, let's say, well-developed sense of intuition and sort of use it to their own benefit, can we think of that as a kind of intelligence?
Yeah, it's a form of, you could call it something, this word we use called metacognition. So if you could train yourself to basically follow the scientific rules, and I'm sure many people have stumbled on these rules and figured them out for themselves just intuitively, pardon the pun, that they can't trust it when they're emotional, that they need to be an expert. They need to have experience with the thing before they can trust their intuition. So we could talk about that as a type of metacognition, as a type of intelligence of its own.
And in terms of developing skills to be more intuitive, how important is it to literally listen to our bodies, our breathing, our posture, our heart rate, our sweating, all those signs that something is going on?
Yeah, so I think the first thing, and this is sort of my second rule, I have this acronym SMILE in the book, and the second rule is self-awareness. And self-awareness is a skill in of its own. It's part of what we call emotional intelligence, and it's trying to be aware of when we go into this heightened state, when we become stressed or anxious. And some people are good at it, some people not so much, but it's a skill that you can train and practice. And people often start with trying to label the state you're in and getting in the habit of that. So when your heart rate goes up, when you are feeling stressed, you become aware of it. And so you can go, oh, okay, just I need a minute here. I'm going to do some breathing exercises. I'm going to maybe meditate. I'm going to do the thing that works for me, try and have a toolkit for bringing that emotional state back down to baseline. And I recommend doing that before you're going to try and use intuition, before you're going to trust it, to get yourself back in that sort of baseline, typical normal state, if you want to use those words, before you trust your intuition.
Another one of these rules that you have, and SMILE is the acronym, mastery. Learn before you leap. Mm-hmm. Why mastery matters for intuition. And I think with John Muir, I think mastery defines, you know, his ability to navigate the world in very dangerous places. But you also raise some really interesting questions about how we learn things, and you know what learning is effective, especially for intuition, and where we can run into some blind spots.
Yeah, absolutely. So the learning behind intuition is an example of, you know, people have probably heard of Pavlov's dogs and the classical conditioning, associative learning, it's called, this type of learning. So it's not like learning, you know, studying for an exam or something like that. It's association. It's a type of learning which happens fairly automatically. And indeed, it can happen unconsciously. So when I gave that example of the restaurant or cafe earlier, crucially, you can't just do that without ever having been to a cafe or a restaurant before. Your brain has to learn through experience these associations between all the different stimuli, all the different things in the cafe, the music, the tablecloths, the hairstyle of the people that work there, the vibe, the color, like hundreds of different things. And your brain, over lots of visits to cafes and restaurants, learns which things there predict good food or bad food or good coffee or bad coffee. And because these things aren't highly emotional, you need to have lots and lots and lots of visits to cafes and restaurants, right? If it was highly emotional, like food poisoning or being in a car crash or something like that, then you don't need many examples. You need way less examples to learn these things. So that's this associative learning. It's happening all the time under the hood to us. So you need to have this experience. Your brain needs to learn the relationships between things in the world. So when you walk into the cafe, these different things in the cafe are triggering, they're red flagging, if you like. They're triggering things, and that's cueing these emotional responses, right? So you have to learn which things are positive, which things are negative. And that's crucially important. If your brain hasn't had the chance to learn these things, you can't really have intuition and you can't trust it. So becoming a master, or mastering different environments, whether it's playing a sport, playing chess, whether it's working in business, whether it's being in the military, whether it's being a new parent, you need to quickly learn these things and master all the different cues in the environment. So your brain can learn that fairly rapidly, and the more emotional it is, right, the higher the stakes, the less examples you need to learn quickly.
Which is fascinating. You also say that research shows that failure and making errors are just so crucial to learning anything. How does that factor into our understanding of intuition?
Yeah, so there's a whole, I mean, there's a, you can have a whole toolkit just on how to learn different things. So, yeah, when we make an error, it's kind of red flags in our brain. Our brain almost has an alarm that goes off. Because when you make a mistake or something goes wrong, right, that's when you need to learn. And that puts the brain in this sort of plastic, malleable learning state. If you're, so our brains are prediction engines. They're predicting what's going to happen next all the time, right? They're just predicting. And when something goes wrong, it's like, whoa, I made a prediction and I got it wrong, right? It sends this alarm throughout your whole brain that something wasn't right. It needs to rejig itself. It needs to learn something new. And so you want to put your, if you want to learn something new, you can try and, you know, you need to be making a certain amount of errors to put your brain in this plastic state. Right, you need feedback. You can't just be getting everything wrong. You need a certain amount of errors. And I think gamification is a really interesting way to think about learning. Right, you see, I talk about this in the book, that gamers, people will play online games for 30, 40, 50 hours straight. They'll eat and nap in front of the computer. And that's because engineers have made these games fairly addictive. But they're learning new things. The people playing the games are learning. So you can think about the feedback, the making errors, the dying, if you like, your character in the game is going to die. So you are making mistakes, but you learn to almost enjoy these failures, these mistakes. That's part of the key to making learning enjoyable and addictive.
Because the failures become rewarding, right? in their own right.
Yeah, too many failures, and if they hurt too much, they can become painful and people won't want to do them. But the key is to think of a failure as, you know, the best learning opportunity. That's when you're going to learn something new. So you actually want to have a certain percentage of failures in whatever you're doing if you're going to be learning. Otherwise, you're not going to be learning that much.
Let me just quote you again and also reintroduce you. And we are talking with our guest today on The Connection, psychologist Joel Pearson. And for many years, he's been studying intuition in his lab. And he's got a new book, and it's titled The Intuition Toolkit. Just picking up, since we've been talking about the brain and how we learn things, you say the brain is not a computer. When we learn something new, our brains physically change. They rewire themselves, cutting older connections and building new ones. Just to underscore sort of this magical thing that's in our head and how it is processing the world.
Yeah, I mean, the brain is the most amazing and the most complex thing we know of, right? It really is orders of magnitude more complicated than any other system we know about. There's just the 86 or so billion neurons, and there's trillions of connections in this, you know, spaghetti maze of complicated connections. We haven't even got close to mapping out the human brain yet, right? That's, we're still working on that. And yeah, I give examples of, you know, if your listeners are old enough like me to remember the first Matrix film, when Neo in the Matrix downloads, you know, new skills, you know, jiu-jitsu and fighting skills, that's just not how learning works, right? We can't just download a new skill, because when we do learn something, the brain is rewiring. I mean, the brain is like this malleable, plastic, amazing thing that's changing. It's changing every day. Every time we learn something new, every experience we go through, the brain changes. And every time we sleep, it rechanges again. It rejigs itself because of those learnings during the day. And so when you learn something, the brain is physically changing. So you can't take, I can't take the learnings from someone else and then download it to my brain, because I would need to physically change my brain. And my brain is bespoke. It's different to yours, Marty, which is different to someone else's. The brain is really like a fingerprint. It's so different in its shapes and curves and its sizes. Some people have larger brains and smaller brains. So it's very bespoke, and it needs to change physically as we learn.
Let me get back to this this tool, the five rules, excuse me, for intuition. We talked about self-awareness. We talked about mastery. We talked a bit about impulses and addiction. Never mistake impulse desires for intuitive insights. You also say resist the temptation of intuition for probabilistic judgments, that we're just really bad with probability. How come?
So the brain just doesn't process numbers very well. And probabilities, we just don't get. There's just so many examples in the literature in psychology where we get numbers wrong. So we're just not good at understanding, especially low probability. So the L in SMILE is for low probability, but it really applies to all probabilistic thinking. And whether this applies to the link between, you know, something like cancer and smoking, or climate change in the environment, or vaccines and things like COVID, or whatever it might be, we're just not good at understanding the numbers. So I live in Sydney, Australia, and I often, when I'm talking to people, I'll call this the shark attack rule.
Hmm.
Because occasionally there'll be, someone will see a shark, or, you know, actually very, very rarely there'll be an incident where a shark would, you know, bite someone. And when that happens, and even now, people get very scared to swim. And it's because we have this thing, most of us have this strong mental imagery, this imagination, where we'll start imagining the shark, we'll imagine the music from Jaws, right? And it happens to me, I'll get scared, I'll get out of the water. But it's still safer than driving, right? One of the funny stats, right, the real Aussie stats, is that more people will be harmed from kangaroos than sharks in Australia.
Oh, is that true? When
you,
really?
When you put it like that, it's
yeah,
even, right?
Friendly looking people, kangaroos, right?
They can be dangerous. They've got sharp claws and they can kick. But when you say, when you think about it, it's so rare that you'll even see a shark, let alone have a physical encounter with one, that you should we should dismiss it, right? It's way more dangerous getting in the car and driving home from work. But we can't. It's so emotive. It's so emotional. So our emotions take over. We just ignore the probabilities. We find it very hard to follow the probabilities, right? It's safer flying than driving. These probabilities will throw us off. We get, in other words, we worry about the things that we have a stronger emotional response to, rather than the things that are actually more likely to kill us.
Do you think, right? It has to do with their teeth? Literally their teeth?
Their teeth. I think it's to do with mental imagery, right? When we imagine something, this is something else that we study in my lab, we have a strong emotional response because our mental imagery amplifies things. It makes it real when it's not real. If I can see a shark in my mind's eye, my limbic system starts responding almost like there's a shark there in front of me. The same if I imagine a snake or a spider. So with this mental imagery that most of us have, not everyone, we can bring these things to life. And that just throws the probabilities out the door, right? So we have to be very careful not to follow our emotions too much in these situations, to fall back on the rational, logical numbers and probabilities. And we have to be careful because it's very tempting to follow the heart, to follow the emotions when it comes to this and use our intuition. But we just shouldn't. We just make it a blanket rule that when it comes to anything around numbers like this and probabilities, just don't use intuition.
And we're almost up on our second break here, but let me just finish up. Your final rule is environment. Only use intuition in familiar and predictable context, that it's not necessarily transferable, what happened in one environment to another environment.
Yeah, absolutely. So the type of learning we mentioned before, this associative learning, when this happens, it actually bakes in the environment you're in. So this was crucially important during COVID when everyone moved from the office to working at home. And a lot of the learnings and the intuition that worked really well have been fine-tuned in the office would not transfer well to being at home. And Steve Jobs is an example I often give for this, just very quickly, that he fine-tuned his intuition. He talked about intuition. He loved it. He used it amazingly at Apple for product design and business decisions. When it came to his home life and particularly his health decisions later in life, he made some very poor decisions about not getting surgery, not getting treatment for his cancer. And people put that down to him sort of not realizing his intuition didn't transfer to different environments and different locations.
So you can use your intuition in one environment, which he clearly did, but obviously completely, it was even beyond intuition, just getting good medical treatment in another environment.
Yeah, so the rule is, in terms of intuition, you just need to be careful when you're changing environments, right? And so when I travel a fair bit, when I'm traveling, I'm in a different part of the world, I have to be very careful, you know, from navigation through to gestures and you know, bodily signals. If I'm a very different culture, these very small things will be very different and my intuition can lead me astray. So I have to be very thoughtful and careful with all kinds of different things when we change the environment.
Well, another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Joel Pearson. He's a psychologist, a neuroscientist, and has been studying intuition for many years now in his lab in Australia. And he's got a new book we've been talking about called The Intuition Toolkit. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and our guest is psychologist Joel Pearson. He says we should pay attention to our intuitions. They're based on the huge amounts of information our brain absorbs every day and stores in our unconscious. Using intuition can tap into that source of data and help us make better decisions. And again, he's founder of the Future Minds Lab, professor at the University of New South Wales in Australia, and author of a new book called The Intuition Toolkit. I think a lot of people, or a fair number of people, will go gambling or play the lottery and feel like, oh, I'm going to use my intuition, my lucky numbers, and that somehow I have sort of special knowledge that's going to make me a winner. How come that doesn't work? I guess the question is, you know, how is that related to superstition or serendipity or coincidence?
Yeah, so there's a number of things. So gambler's fallacy is a well-known one. And there's this, you know, so the gambler's fallacy is when you see, you know, if you're playing in pretty much any game and something comes up, let's say it's red comes up, you know, four times in a row, and you're playing roulette or something.
Right.
People start thinking that, oh, a black is due. But each time you take a new card or you spin the wheel, whatever it is, the probabilities reset. So if it's red and black, it's 50-50 on each spin of the wheel. And so each spin is unrelated to the prior things. But you can't help thinking that, oh, there's four or five blacks in a row, then a red must come. And that's an example of gambler's fallacy. And people will, even if you tell them that logic and they know it, they'll still bet against it. They'll start feeling that it's due. But then all these superstitious things come in. People have special lucky shoes and hats and sunglasses and want to cross their fingers for this or that. And that's an example of where we just throw the probabilities out the window again. And we start to have these what's called magical beliefs come into play. So yeah, that's an example where these kind of things will cross over with intuition and people won't follow the logic. And we need to be just careful. That's not intuition. That is just the nature of the human brain.
And our desire to make patterns or make sense of things that feel so random, at least it feels that way.
Yeah, I mean, the law of large numbers is an interesting one. And so people often ask me, well, what about, you know, I had a dream about a plane crash and then a plane crashed and it was a premonition. Joel, how could that really just be what you're talking about? It felt like I was tapped in to the blueprint of the universe. And it's a sixth sense. I felt that. And, you know, I don't want to be, you know, I'm a scientist, but I don't want to, you know, be overly negative with that. The way I think about intuition is that we can explain it with all the neuroscience data we already have. We don't need to bring in extra stuff. And we may one day, but not at this stage. But the law of large numbers, when you think about how many people, say in the US, have dreams every night, and most people have many dreams every night, let's say four, five, six, and plane crashes is quite an emotional topic, and so quite a large proportion of people do dream about such things. And you can start running the numbers, and you find out that every night we should expect a large number of people to dream about plane crashes. Therefore, if there's ever, you know, an incident with a plane, it's absolutely expected that the night before a lot of people would have dreamed about it. So it's completely normal. It's nothing out of the ordinary. And yeah, it's called apophonia. It's this strong desire we have to see patterns in things, and we see coincidences, and we add meaning to it, and that feels very, I don't know, fulfilling psychologically. Yeah. Yeah. Even though it can just happen by chance, right? If you're flipping a coin, you do it over and over and over, you know, 1,000 times. You're gonna have 20, 30, 50 heads in a row at some point, and that's completely normal. That should be expected. When you see that, it feels strange and special. So yeah, absolutely. We can't help but see the patterns in nature.
What's the difference between instinct and intuition?
Yeah, so a lot of people will use those two words interchangeably. But in the book, I wanted to make a point that they are different and we should be clear about that. So instincts are things we're born with. So they're hardwired. We see that all over the place in the animal kingdom. We see it in humans, though, as well. You know, if you give a baby a lemon and they taste it, their face will screw up from very early. That's sort of that response to bitter flavors is something that's inbuilt. Our love of comfort and our hate of discomfort is something built in. And I talk about also uncertainty. Yeah. Is another instinct that we're but basically all primates and pretty much all animals have a dislike of uncertainty. It feels uncomfortable. It's like a fear stimulus. And this is a big deal at the moment with AI and the world changing so rapidly. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. And so that's something that, as we evolve, was very adaptive. And in today's modern world, it's become maladaptive. And so instincts are hardwired and they can often become maladaptive, whereas intuition is dynamic. It's based on learning. So it can change as we go. It changes with new experiences, new mastery. So it's dynamic and changeable. Instincts are hardwired. And we don't really want to confuse the two.
I'm thinking about those moments when you feel a person feels in danger and you often just sort of react without thinking. And it feels very instinctual. I mean, maybe you're driving and you see someone coming at you in the lane. You're going to react in a certain kind of way. Is that intuition in work that it's beyond thinking. We're just reacting.
It would depend. So there are, our bodies will react. to things to save our, you know, we see something moving towards us, we'll just move out of the way. Right. We put our hand on a hot plate on the stove, we'll move it back pretty much before we're even conscious of it being hot. You see a spider and you're going to move away from it very quick. So we can do a lot of things almost automatically, you know. But and in the book, I talk about Jason, who's a pilot, a well-trained pilot. And if you are driving or flying, you know, if you've trained well, then it does become intuition. Mm-hmm. And you can make rapid decisions from unconscious information that will save your life. And the story I go into at the beginning of the book about Jason, where he pulled up and he saved the plane, he saved his life without even realizing he was doing it. And so if you're an expert at driving, at flying, at rock climbing, at basketball, you know, whatever it might be, you can have the ability to tap into the unconscious information and do things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do. But you need to be a master. You need to have that experience to hone that intuition.
I'm thinking, though, of a parent, you know, sort of fishing their child out of a, you know, happen to be in the roadway or something like that. I mean, there are where you're not thinking and you're not an expert. You're just trying to save your child.
Yes, absolutely. So that'll probably be largely instinct. Maybe it's a mix of the two, mm-hmm. right? So I often talk about this, as new parents will very rapidly become super experts, we'll get mastery. You know, I remember when my kids were born, you know, within, you know, a week or two, I could be asleep, but I'd hear the cry, you know, and I'd be awake instantly. I'm sure I could tell their cry. And there's data on this. Parents can very quickly tell that their child, their baby's cry from the sound of other babies crying very, very quickly. And we learn, you know, the first time your child gets sick and the doctor will say, you know, are they themselves? Are they acting normal? And it's it's kind of a strange question, but you can tell as a new parent very quickly, there's something off in the subtleties of the way they're moving their eyes, the way they're, you know, crying, the way they're moving their body. And that's intuition. That's very rapid intuition that you're learning very quickly as a new parent. And so, instincts like that where you're going to, you know, grab your child, they're running, you know, they're going to fall into the water or something or running towards the road. There's going to be a mix of some intuition there, but probably, you know, instinct as well.
From your studies and other people that have been studying intuition, are there differences between men and women and intuition?
This is the question that everyone loves to ask.
Of course.
So in our lab test that we've developed that is objective and reliable, we haven't really gone deep on this yet. That being said, there's a lot of questionnaire data, and we certainly know that women report using intuition way more than men in everyday life. Along with these experiments, people often look at emotionality. Women, on average, generally speaking, will report being more emotional and using emotion in their decision-making more. They will also, again, on average, report more what's called magical thinking, generally speaking, except when it comes to like gambling and particularly sports. There you see a complete flip around where men tend to just take on all this superstitious thinking and, like I said, cross their fingers, wear their lucky hat when their team's playing. So you see this interesting flip over there. But generally speaking, women will report using intuition in daily decision-making more than men.
Are people who are artistic, are they more intuitive or more suited to intuition?
Oh, great question, Marty. I don't have, you know, really good data on that. I think that everyone can use intuition. So I talk to creatives, to designers, to artists. I talk to a lot of CEOs, C-suite level management who use intuition. And I think what's interesting, and part of the reason I wanted to write this book and create this sort of science around intuition, because a lot of those people at high level leadership don't yet feel comfortable talking publicly about using their intuition for big decisions. You know, if this is a big, you know, huge, many billion dollar company, they feel a bit, there's still a taboo around saying, oh, I made this decision using intuition. Even though we now have the science to understand it, it's still a little taboo. And that's something I want to change. I want people to understand that we now have a scaffolding of science around there. And if you are an expert in your field and you follow these five rules from the book, then it is legitimate to say, hey, I used intuition for this decision, right? It was the best option. I had to make a rapid decision. There's a lot of different factors there. There's ambiguous information, and I didn't have much time. Then using intuition is probably the best bet if you know, they're not highly emotional, if they are an expert, if they follow these rules. So that's also, yeah, what I'm trying to do is to move the taboo away from intuition, right? And bring the emotion, the decision-making, the more alternative parts and definitions of intuition all into this one field of science that we can start to unpack, understand, and help people make better decisions, build these practical guides for people to improve their decision-making and their everyday lives.
What I heard you say in the business world is that things are happening quickly and that people often have to make a very quick decision with perhaps incomplete knowledge. Is that where someone who's skilled with intuition can rely, feel confident about whatever decision they make?
Yeah, I think, and that is, I hear this more and more from business leaders, that they just have to, they don't have a choice. They used to have the luxury of being able to have the time to go through more data and wait for more data to come in. Nowadays, they don't. They have to make rapid decisions with incomplete data sets. And if they can use your intuition to, you know, tap into this extra reservoir of information in their brain, then that's an advantage. That's an advantage they can have. They just need to learn and know that they can trust that. And that is happening. So that is part of why I wrote this book, because I want to get these tools out into everyone's hands to improve decision-making. And so no one feels funny about it. No one feels awkward or, you know, taboo-y about this. And, you know, the US military talks about intuition. There's all these cases of intuition saving lives in the US military. It's talked about in sport. It's talked about with new parents. It's talked about at high levels of leadership in politics and business. So it's something that's coming from left and right, from all different fields. And we need to bring all that together, do more science, do more psychological research, do more neuroscience research, and help everyone make better decisions.
I noticed in your bio that you studied intuition, as obvious because we've been talking about it for an hour, but also imagination. What's the connection between the two? I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, so we study something called aphantasia in the lab, and mental imagery, you know, the imagination and how that crosses over. So the two cross over, sort of probably the best example is the one we've already talked about, which is the imagination is like an amplifier of emotions. And that's really one of the strongest cases of where mental imagery changes our lives, changes our decision-making, is it amplifies emotions. And this can be fantastic when we're reading a book, a novel, and people that have strong imagery talk about how they can picture the main character and they get pulled into the story emotionally. But when it comes to anxiety and PTSD, then this can be really bad, right? Strong mental imagery can amplify negative thoughts, and they can become really distressing and interfere with our lives. And so when it comes to decision-making and intuition, we just need to be careful of the fact that mental imagery can amplify the emotions, like the shark attack example, and bias our decisions. And it can pull us down and really stop us from following the probabilities and numbers when it becomes example of the shark or getting on a plane, right? We want to stick with the numbers and probabilities, and that is our best bet for living, you know, a long and rich life.
So when should we not use intuition? I think I understand not, but in summary, when not?
Let me just circle back. We didn't talk much about the eye and smile. And I just want to point out that the feeling of addictive substances, you're smoking, you're drinking, your drugs, but also your social media, your gambling, the pull towards addictive things can be very sneaky. It can feel like intuition. And people can often sort of justify an addiction as intuition. And we don't want to do that. We just want to separate out intuition and addictive processes and substances. And that's just including eating and food. So intuitive eating is a whole subdomain in itself that we probably don't have time to get into, but we want to be very careful when we're thinking about eating intuitively, because it can be very dangerous, and likewise with any addiction. So that's just one of the other examples that I wanted to point out to sort of guide our decision making. So we should try, and we should, when we have limited data, when we need to make a rush decision, right? So all sporting events, all football and basketball and whatever it would be, they are great examples of when we should use intuition. So limited ambiguous information and time pressure, probably the best examples of when we should use intuition. what people tend to report is when they have a big decision coming up, right, to get married, divorced, or buy or sell a house or move country, all of a sudden they start thinking and feeling emotion around that. And they'll start saying, oh, I'm going to follow my gut. But what tends to happen is they're not practiced at doing that. So what I talk about in the book is wanting to practice using intuition with smaller decisions. Keep a diary, keep a spreadsheet, if you like, of how you use your intuition. Practice it for smaller decisions. So when these bigger decisions come up, you're well experienced at modulating your emotional state and getting into a better state for making decisions. And you're very familiar with the interoception, what it feels like to tap in to the unconscious information using your body.
Well, Joel, we have to leave it there. We are out of time. Joel Pearson, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you, Marty. I really appreciate it and appreciate your support.
Absolutely. Founder of Future Minds Lab, professor at the University of New South Wales in Australia, author of a new book called The Intuition Toolkit. Debbie Bilder is the producer of The Connection. Our engineer today, Diana Martinez. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.